CBS World News brings you the early morning reports of its correspondents for the News of the World on Thursday, June 25th. Today we shall call in Washington and London and attempt to get you a report direct by shortwave radio from Cairo. In addition, Harry Marble will give you the latest news from points not covered by our direct pickup. But first, here are the highlights today. The British report Axis forces already well inside Egypt. The Red Army defenders of Sevastopol again have been forced back. In China, the news appears a little better. While in the Southwest Pacific, action was limited to aerial reconnaissance, this time over the Celebes Islands. And now for more news and to call in Columbia's correspondent, here is Harry Marble.
Before calling in Washington this morning, here is the situation in Russia. The newspaper Pravda admitted that heavy German pressure, without regard to losses, again has forced the Russians back on the northern sector of the Sevastopol front. But the BBC, as heard by Columbia's shortwave listening post, reports that the Russians have landed Marines on the south coast of the Crimea to outflank the Nazi attackers. To the north, at Kharkov in the Ukraine, the midnight Soviet communique said Red Army forces had repulsed the Nazi infantry and tank attacks. On other sectors, the official war bulletin said there were no changes. And now let's hear from CBS correspondents in important world centers. Our first report comes this morning from our own nation's capital, so we take you now to Washington.
CBS Washington, John Purcell reporting. The Roosevelt-Churchill conferences are nearing completion, and observers here expect word soon on what has been accomplished in the daily conversations held since last Friday. Today, the President and Prime Minister will meet at the White House with congressional leaders. This group will include key men in Republican congressional circles, as well as their Democratic colleagues. It is assumed that the two allied leaders would make known the decisions they have reached and review the war situation. There are reports, too, that some of the congressional group would like to question Mr. Churchill about America's part in the opening of a second front. That is, just what amount of American aid is needed. Following the congressional conference, the two allied leaders will meet with the Pacific War Council. The war in the Pacific has not claimed the attention of allied leaders in the last week, as much as the more critical situations in Russia and Africa. But during the week, Chinese Foreign Minister T.V. Tsung was called into the discussion. The situation in China, as you know, has become critical mostly because of the failure to supply China with sufficient air power. Prime Minister Mackenzie King of Canada has arrived here to take part in the Pacific War Council meeting. And undoubtedly, there will be some discussion of the Japanese occupations in the Aleutians. Both American and Canadian airmen have been bombing Jap landing forces on Attu and Kiska, but have been hampered by the fogs that encircle the Aleutian chain. Since Sunday, there has been no announcement of developments in that area. General Arnold, the chief of the Army Air Force, will appear today before the Senate Appropriations Committee to answer a few questions on the $43 billion Army supply bill. One subject he will discuss is that of the relative merits of American and Japanese fighting planes. Senator Thomas of Oklahoma says he has been informed that the Jap Zero fighter is among the fastest in the world. Airmen here admit this, but also point out that the Zero fighter has sacrificed armor and self-sealing gas tanks for speed and maneuverability. They say that a well-directed cannon shot will blow any Zero fighter out of the air. But of course, American fighting pilots would like to see industrial inventiveness in fighter production catch up with that displayed in the manufacture of bombers. This capital is intensely interested in the growing feeling of resentment in Argentina against the Hitler regime. As you know, German U-boats have torpedoed three Argentine merchant ships. But it is regarded here as unlikely that Argentina will veer from her course of strict neutrality. The government is under heavy pressure to change its attitude from that adopted during the Rio conference. You will recall that all of the South American nations, except Argentina and Chile, agreed to sever diplomatic relations with the Axis. Last night, angry mobs stormed the German embassy at Buenos Aires. Newspapers are demanding some kind of diplomatic action. But official Washington expects no more than another protest dispatched to the German government and possibly a cabinet shakeup in the South American country. And as far as the United States is concerned, this is strictly a matter between Argentina and Germany. This is John Purcell in Washington, returning you to CBS New York.
Next, across the Atlantic to the British capital. We take you now to London.
CBS London, Charles Collingwood reporting. The British got five German bombers last night. German raids on England were on a little larger scale than usual. Bombs were dropped along the coast, and some of the raiders penetrated inland as far as Britain's great industrial area of the Midlands. This morning's British communique says that some damage was done, but the number of casualties was not large. The five German aircraft destroyed must have been a substantial percentage of the raiding force. British bombers last night attacked the submarine base at Saint-Nazaire without loss. This raid on Saint-Nazaire was evidently a small one, but it fits into the present air strategy of the British Bomber Command. British bombers are concentrating on German U-boats. Daylight reconnaissance yesterday showed that the U-boat yards at Emden were still burning after Monday night's raid. Those submarine yards were one of the main targets of the raid. And diesel engine factories at Cologne, which make engines for U-boats, were aimed at in the famous Thousand Bomber Raid. And then last night, the RAF struck at Saint-Nazaire, the nest from which many U-boats go out into the Atlantic. The RAF is doing its part in the never-ending battle of the Atlantic. Inside Britain, the repercussions of the fall of Tobruk still dominate the scene. Today's communique from Cairo reveals that the British Eighth Army has abandoned the frontier line and taken a long step back into Egypt. This has not surprised military experts, but to the public it looks bad. British public opinion is no more constant than any other public opinion, and the Libyan retreat has changed the whole public attitude toward the war. The optimism of this spring has ended, and the British have once again realized that the war is still a long way from being won. They're just as sure, though, as ever, that the war will be won. Political prophets are guessing that the Middle East situation must have changed the tenor of the conversations which Mr. Churchill is having in Washington. That may or may not be so, but it has certainly changed the British attitude to them. The disposition to believe that a second front is imminent has given way to a new realization that a second front depends on more than the desire to create one. The war has suddenly come to seem very large. The misfortunes of the Eighth Army in Libya have caused people to think of the many fronts on which the war is already being fought. The defeat in Libya has come here in London to be a symbol of all the difficulties which lie between the present position and victory. The British are awaiting with some impatience Mr. Churchill's return to this country. But the first thing they want to hear from him is not hints of the decisions which were made in Washington, but a survey and an explanation of the setback in the Middle East. Mr. Churchill is expected to make such a statement to the House of Commons after he gets back. The House will doubtless be in a restive mood, but the danger of any real parliamentary revolt is growing less and less. The insurgents in the House, those who in the first heat of anger were ready to declare their lack of confidence in the government, has not increased, although a no-confidence motion signed by 21 members of Parliament is down for debate. Most observers expect the Prime Minister to mollify the House with a frank account of the setback and of the dangers which follow from it. While London is talking and debating, the Eighth Army, now across the border, is preparing for the defense of Egypt. Our next report comes from the capital of Egypt. We take you now to Cairo.
CBS Egypt, Edward Shorian reporting. Three German columns crossed the Egyptian frontier yesterday at Madalena, 60 miles south of the coast. British mobile forces and the Royal Air Force engaged them all day yesterday, inflicting heavy losses on the enemy. One German column turned north towards the coast road, while the other two proceeded east in the direction of Mersa Matruh. By last light yesterday evening, these two columns had reached a point southeast of Sidi Barani. British troops have withdrawn from their positions at Saloum and Sidi Omar. In the air, American liberators and British Wellingtons yesterday carried out what is considered the biggest and heaviest raid yet on shipping and the harbor installations at Benghazi. Details of the raid are not yet available. Our observer, writing from advanced headquarters, says, "We are waiting for the battle for Egypt to begin. The waiting is not very pleasant. It's hot out here and a parched, summer-gripped desert. Too hot to let you touch even the steel fenders of your car at midday without scorching your skin. But heat isn't the only thing. A breeze is throwing the powder-fine dust about in choking clouds. Dust gets into everything, your tea, your stew, your eyes, your nose. Those are the conditions in which the Eighth Army is meeting Rommel's latest drive. Out here, he says, we are still, all of us, puzzled about the mystery of Tobruk. Why did Tobruk fall? Well, we just don't know.
Officers and men who took part in the fighting are already beginning to straggle back.
It is possible from their stories to piece together some sort of a picture of the storming of Tobruk.
The 8th Army had ample warning of the possibility that Tobruk would again be besieged,
and they heeded that warning. There was a strong force inside when the Axis went through the defenses like a hot knife through butter. It simply seems that Schuck's tactics worked again, that Rommel, the great military gambler, took a chance on pushing his tanks through the defensive perimeter, disrupting and throwing into confusion the British and South African troops, and exploiting the advantage he had gained where they were still stunned by the speed of it all. Anyway, it worked. I am told, he says, that the cost of maintaining each man in the Tobruk garrison was $45 a day, figured, of course, on the cost of ships lost in carrying supplies, aircraft lost in defending the area, ammunition fired off by the artillery, and so on. Well, Tobruk has gone, and it's no use denying the importance of the blow. British prestige is not actually British capacity to conduct a desert campaign has suffered in the loss. Yesterday, he writes, the first enemy shells fell on Egyptian soil again. I was standing on a ridge a few miles from Saloum when the enemy gunners started shelling. It was the first sign that the Germans were within striking distance of the frontier. No doubt the artillery attack was a triumph to a general front. I came up the road in the morning to a sector of the Saloum front and spent an hour with the British gunners there. They were having things all their own way just then. A troop of 4.5 howitzers was right forward, slinging shells over the lip of the steep escarpment in the general area of Capuzzo. At that time, they had no information of strong enemy concentrations there. On the contrary, an observer, who was moving around the top of the escarpment in a truck, could see nothing but odd vehicles coming and going round Capuzzo. Not even a large convoy, much less an armored column. There is no doubt that the 8th Army has taken a heavy knock in recent fighting, but it is still a formidable fighting force, despite the loss of many men and considerable equipment at Tobruk. The 8th Army will probably prove the truth of this claim within the next few days. That was a dispatch from our observer at the front. In the Egyptian Chamber of Deputies yesterday, the Egyptian Prime Minister, dealing with the present situation, stated that he was fully convinced that despite all difficulties, the situation is satisfactory, and that the position of Egypt's ally, Great Britain, is better than it was last year. The British government, he said, categorically affirms that Britain is firmly resolved to resist to the utmost extent any and all aggression against Egyptian territory. The Prime Minister went on by issuing a stern warning to rumor mongers, who he said would be dealt with by severe and swift military punishment. He stated, in the present circumstances, it was the duty of everyone inhabiting Egypt to remain vigilant and cautious, and to denounce immediately any rumor mongers or spies. This is Edward Shorian in Cairo, returning you to CBS, New York.
General MacArthur radioed this message today to his friend, General Sir Claude J.E. Auchinleck, Commander-in-Chief of the recently defeated British Middle East Forces. Said MacArthur, you can do it. You can still fight your way through. Remember Wellington. You have just heard from Columbia's correspondents across the world reporting the latest news direct by shortwave radio. This morning you heard from John Purcell in Washington, from Charles Collingwood in London, and Edward Chorlian in Cairo. Harry Marvel reporting for CBS World News. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.